Good evening. It's great to see you all this evening. A special welcome to those of you who are here for the first time worshiping with us at Unity. We're glad that you're here. We hope you find Unity Church to be a place which helps you to find and keep your balance, a place which nourishes you to lead a loving life of integrity, service, and joy. Following the service this afternoon, you're invited to join us for refreshments, coffee and tea in the parish hall. There you can meet old and new friends, visit our welcome table and the book stall. If you're interested in learning more about becoming a member of Unity Church, please visit the welcome table that's in the parish hall. Our children's and adult libraries are also open after every service and available to you. The libraries are on the second floor of the Elliott Wing. Join us this Wednesday for Wellspring Wednesdays. There's a dinner at 6 o'clock, a short worship service at 6:45, and then classes begin at 7:15. Our featured speaker this week is Kate Cabot, who is the author of The Voices of Rondo, which is a look at this community right here and just north of us. Should be a wonderful, wonderful lecture. Following this service in the Gannett Room, there will be an informational meeting about the upcoming trip to New Orleans in March. If you're interested in this trip, interested in going and rebuilding houses, cleaning houses, gutting these houses, please attend this session. Also, if some of you are interested and willing to give an occasional ride to a Unity member who is unable to come to church because of unreliable transportation or no transportation, there's a sign-up sheet on the welcome table in the parish hall. It could be a once a month or every 2 months commitment, but it would allow someone who's not a part of this worshiping community to be here with us and worship with us. So if you can give someone a ride, please sign up on that sheet. Next Sunday marks the official end of this year's pledge drive. As you know, it is your pledges that support Unity Church, the work and vision of this church. You should know that at this point, we are about $60,000 short of our goal, about 94% of the way there. So if you haven't yet made your pledge, I invite you to consider what this church and its ministry means to you and the wider community, how its programs, classes, and various offerings have impacted your life as you seek to live a more full life of integrity, service, and joy. And if you've already pledged, and you feel like increasing your pledge, that's fine too. Next Sunday, Teresa Schwartz and Worship Associate Dick Bugs will lead the service entitled Deep Democracy. Services are at 9, 11, and 4:30. Finally, at the conclusion of the service, Teresa and I would love to meet you and greet you at the Portland Avenue doors. And once again, welcome to Unity Church.
From death to life, from falsehood to truth, lead us from despair to hope, from fear to trust. Let peace fill our hearts, our world, our universe. Let let us dream together, pray together, work together to build one world of peace and justice for all. Come, let us worship together. Please join in our unison reading, number 580. The central task is to unveil the bonds that bind each to all. There is a connectedness, a relationship discovered amid the particulars of our own lives and the lives of others. Once felt, it inspires us to act for justice. It is the church that assures us that we are not struggling for justice on our own, but as members of a larger community. The religious community is essential, for a together, our vision widens and our strength is renewed.
Every Sunday when we gather, we set aside time to expand the caring ministry of this congregation. Together we recognize the cycle of life and death, the circle of love, compassion, and witness that permeates this sacred place. Our hearts are with all those who live with grief or chronic pain, for illnesses seen and unseen, those who live with addiction, those who care for family members in ill health, and those who knowingly face their final days with courage and dignity. This evening, our hearts are with Eleanor Felker, whose grandson died unexpectedly last week. We hold in our prayers Phil Dorn, who fell and cracked a rib last week. We hold in our hearts Katie Rivard, who is home from successful surgery and recovering well. And our prayers are with Alex Chandler, who will be having surgery this Wednesday to remove a cancerous tumor. May we stand in compassionate solidarity with our neighbors all around the world who suffer in the midst of habitual violence. May they and we be instruments of a lasting peace. I now invite you to share the names of those people you would like to celebrate or memorialize or hold in the embrace this community. For the names which have been spoken and the names which remain in the silent sanctuary of our hearts, may we be forever grateful for the lives that have touched ours. And let us join together in prayer and silent meditation. Holy One, source of love and life that goes by many names, we gather as one body this evening to celebrate all that we have. and to rededicate ourselves to those things worthy of our deepest commitments. We give thanks for the fellowship and laughter in our lives, because it is fellowship and laughter that truly feed our spirit. We give thanks for the many hands and kind words that have supported us during moments of loss and grief, because it is love and kindness that heal our spirit. We give thanks for the opportunity to serve this world, to sing, to dance, to volunteer, to share our gifts with those around us, because it is in giving that we truly receive. We give thanks for life, for fellowship, for laughter, for family and friends, for the chance to do our part, to play our note in the music of life. Take time in our service this evening to recognize an important and vital ministry of this church, those who volunteer on Sunday mornings and Sunday afternoons to greet and welcome you to the church, to hand out orders of service, to be hospitable to you. I would like to invite Meg and Libby Arnasta to come up and speak to you a little bit about the Welcome Team ministry.
Every Sunday, for each service, a group of volunteers gathers to welcome members, friends, and visitors to Unity. They greet people at the door, set up coffee and tea service, hand out orders of worship, and take the offering.
Unity Church Unitarian has over 150 volunteers who staff the 12 welcome teams. Each volunteer serves at one service a month. Fifth Sundays are covered by special teams comprised of board members, coming-of-age participants, covenant groups, and other members willing to serve once a year.
Today, we would like to recognize all the volunteers who have served on a welcome team in the past year. Your service is so important to the well-being of this church. Would all the welcome team members please stand so that the congregation can show its appreciation?
We thank you for your help and the warm hospitality you bring to each service.
If you're not a member of a welcome team, we invite you to join one. We would like everyone who attends Unity regularly to be on a team because many hands make light work. It's also a great experience for the team members, so come and join us.
Please fill out the form in your order of worship or contact Laura Park at the church. We also invite you to join us for the annual Welcome Team Potluck on Saturday, February 10th.
Since mid-October, every Sunday we collect and give away our offering to organizations and nonprofits in the community doing valuable, life-changing work in line with Unity's mission and values. This evening, our offering will go to the Open Cities Health Center, an organization that has existed for over 40 years, serving a wide population of people, many of whom do not have health insurance or insurance of any sort, and yet still receive medical care. It's a wonderful organization in our neighborhood, and our own Vivian Stone is a member of the board of this organization. I hope you'll give generously to this important cause. Will the ushers please come forward? May this offering be a blessing and a gift to those who receive it.
The Low Road by Marge Piercy. What can they do to you? Whatever they want. They can set you up, they can bust you, they can break your fingers, they can burn your brain with electricity, blur you with drugs till you can't walk, can't remember. They can take your child, wall up your lover. They can do anything you can't blame them from doing. How can you stop them? Alone you can fight, you can refuse, but
You can take revenge, but they can roll over you. But two people fighting back to back can cut through a mob. A snake dancing file can break a cordon. An army can meet an army. Two people can keep each other sane, can give support, conviction, love, massage, hope, sex. Three people are a delegation, a committee, a wedge. With four, you can play bridge and start an organization. With six, you can rent a whole house and eat pie for dinner with no seconds. And you can hold a fundraising party. A dozen make a demonstration. 100 fill a hall. 1,000 have solidarity in your own newsletter. 10,000 power in your own paper. 100,000 your own media. 10 million your own country. It goes on, one at a time. It starts when you care to act. It starts when you do it again after they said no. It starts when you say we, and you know who you mean, and each day you mean one more.
In 1966, Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. was the General Assembly's Ware Lecturer. There he talked about this term, creative maladjustment, and in his speech to several thousand Unitarian Universalists at General Assembly, he said, in part, "Yes, I must confess that I believe firmly that our world is in dire need of a new organization, the International Association for the Advancement of Creative Maladjustment. Men and women as maladjusted as the prophet Amos, who in the midst of the injustices of his day cried out the words that echo across the centuries, let justice roll down like waters and righteousness like a mighty stream. Yes, as maladjusted as Abraham Lincoln, who had the vision to see that this nation could not survive half slave and half free. As maladjusted as Thomas Jefferson, who in the midst of an age amazingly adjusted to slavery, cried in words lifted to cosmic proportions, we hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, that they are endowed by their creator with certain inalienable rights, that among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. As maladjusted as Jesus of Nazareth, who could say to the men and women of his day, he who lives by the sword shall perish by the sword. Through such maladjustment, we will be able to emerge from the bleak and desolate midnight of man's inhumanity to man, into the bright and glittering daybreak of freedom and justice." Martin Luther King Jr., author Michael Eric Dyson recalls a sermon he hears at Riverside Church. It wasn't James Forbes who was preaching, however, it was Forbes's friend Charles Adams. Halfway through the sermon, Charles Adams turns his attention to the Martin Luther King holiday and the forces that seek to twist King's memory and thwart his progressive agenda. Charles Adams goes on in the sermon, "Perhaps the easiest way to get rid of Martin Luther King Jr. is to worship him, to honor him with a holiday that he never would have wanted, to celebrate his birth and his death without committing ourselves to his vision and his love. It is easier, said Adams, to praise a dead hero than to recognize and follow a living prophet." Dick Gilbert, a Unitarian Universalist minister and one of my teachers at Meadville Lombard, tells a story about a minister who preached at the church that Franklin Roosevelt attended when he was president. The minister receives a phone call one Saturday evening, and the caller asks, "Will the president be in church tomorrow?" And the preacher pauses just a moment and says, "Well, I'm not sure, but we do expect God to be there. And I think that's sufficient reason for good attendance." Dick Gilbert then follows this story with something from Soren Kierkegaard. "Too often in their churches, people adopt an attitude of the theater, imagining that the preacher is an actor and that they, the congregation, are his or her drama critics." And Kierkegaard offers this corrective. Actually, the people, the congregation, they are the actors on the stage of life, and the preacher is merely the prompter, reminding the people of their lost lines. And it is the holy that is the critical audience. At least that's the hope. That's the dream. It's certainly easier to hero worship or to be a drama critic, which is perhaps why generation after generation, prophets and sages and saints try to remind us of our lost lines. Their ongoing effort suggests that we do have the ability, that we know somewhere deep inside what those lines are, how we are to be in relationship with one another, with ourselves, with the world. But we are often forgetful, willful, resistant people. Today, let us listen to these living prophets, those whose vision and courage might lead us to a world of peace and justice, to the beloved community. It was Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. who popularized the term beloved community, but he was not the first to use this term. That distinction belongs to Josiah Royce, a late 19th century professor of philosophy. Royce imagined the beloved community as an ideal sort of community, a group of people who came together, who were committed to the cause of loyalty and truth and to ultimate reality, who came together with fierce loyalty and commitment to a particular. Yet long before Royce and King spoke of beloved community, it has had a deep yearning in the human heart. Perhaps an early version of the beloved community begins with Moses, the stuttering, reluctant leader of the Israelites who leads them from slavery out of Egypt. As you remember, Moses has a mountaintop experience with God, where he receives the Ten Commandments, as well as this continued confirmation, this vision of the promised land, the place of milk and honey, of freedom for his people, of living in harmony. Perhaps Moses comes back down from the mountain and says to his people, as he notices they're worshiping a golden calf and questioning his leadership, maybe he says, "Well, guys, the good news is we've got them down to 10. And this promised land sure does sound good. But you're dancing around a golden calf, and what are you doing? You've forgotten your lines, your promise, your covenant with one another. But Moses doesn't give up. He leads on to the promised land, traveling in the desert for 40 years. And as he nears the end of his days, Moses stands atop a mountain next to the promised land, a mountain right next to the promised land, and he looks over. He can see it. But he dies on that mountaintop, just short of the dream. Jesus, as a subversive wisdom teacher, speaks and acts out of a politics of compassion and rallies against the great evil, as he saw it, the politics of purity. As author Marcus Borg says, the inclusive vision in Jesus' table fellowship is reflected in the shape of the Jesus movement itself. It was an inclusive movement, negating the boundaries of the purity system, those rules and regulations that denied a person's worth and dignity, and continually harmed women, the untouchables, the poor, the maimed, and the marginalized. In a society ordered by a strict purity system, separating the whole from the broken, the saved from the unsaved, the rich from the poor, Jesus' movement revealed a radically different social vision. And with this new vision, Jesus sought to usher in the kingdom of God, a new socio-political reality in which everyone, and then one more than you even imagined, would sit around the welcome table. Now, speaking of Moses and Jesus, and this may be a slight digression, have you heard the one about the burglar who breaks into a house and he hears a soft voice saying, "Jesus is watching you"? He thinks he's imagining it, so he continues on through the house looking for things to steal, but again he hears this voice, "Jesus is watching you." So he turns around with his flashlight and he sees a parrot in a cage. And he says, "Are you talking?" And the parrot says, "Yeah." He says, "What's your name?" "Moses," the parrot says. "What kind of crazy people name their parrot Moses?" says the burglar. "The same kind of crazy people that name their pit bull Jesus," says the parrot. Now, if you'll go with me on this, and this may be a stretch, but if you'll go with me on this, perhaps it's fair to say, and we'll come back to this joke later on, it ties in. It's fair to say that Jesus was, in some metaphorical sense, a pit bull, fighting for peace and justice and the politics of compassion in his life. Certainly, his life and his ethics inspired Thomas Jefferson to create his own version of the Gospels. Jefferson, as you know, took a knife to the four Gospels and took out everything that was supernatural or the miracle stories, and what he was left with was the Jefferson Bible, as you probably know, and he considered that to be wisdom from the great common sense teacher. So obviously Jefferson was inspired by Jesus' ethics and teachings. And this showed up in the Declaration of Independence when Jefferson wrote, "We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men, all people, are created equal, that they are endowed by their Creator with certain inalienable rights, that among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness." These self-evident truths point toward a beloved community waiting to happen. And the covenant of this country, the sacred promise of the Declaration of Independence, was reaffirmed by Abraham Lincoln in his Gettysburg Address. He reminded the Union that it was dedicated to the proposition that all people are created equal, and that this nation under God shall have a new birth of freedom, and that the government of the people, by the people, and for the people shall not perish from the earth. Again, without saying it, Lincoln takes us right to the doorstep of the beloved community. lifting up those lost lines that we must remember if our grand experiment in democracy is to work at all. Granted, there is much missing in this loose exploration of beloved community, of its history and ideas. There's wisdom from Eastern philosophy and traditions. There's wisdom from native communities around the world. But one piece I don't want to skip is the way in which women have drawn out the deeply relational aspects of the beloved community. Author and lecturer Starhawk writes, "All is relationship. All is relationship. And we must make our relationships one of love, love of self and other, and raging love against all that would diminish the unspeakable beauty of the world." And Sharon Welch, a UU writer, says, "The beloved community names the matrix within life which is celebrated. Love is worship, and partial victories over injustice lay the groundwork for future acts of courage and defiance." This web or matrix of relationships is fundamental to any sort of beloved community. It is knowing and understanding the connectedness of things, knowing that the food grown here by certain people feeds people over here. It is knowing that a war fought over here pulls here and here and here on communities and countries. The web of relationships invites us to consider the we story. In their book, The Art of Possibility, Ben and Rosamund Zander explain the we story. The we story points to relationships rather than individuals. It is the story of the unseen threads that connect us all. It is the story of possibility. By telling the we story, an individual becomes a conduit for this new inclusive entity. An individual hears with bigger ears and eyes and feels with a bigger heart, inquiring and asking the question, what is best for us? If we describe revenge and greed and pride and fear and self-righteousness as the villain, and people as the hope, then the enemy to conquer is never a human being. And the question that is continually asked is, what is best for us? So if you thought that joke earlier was a little bit out of place, and it might have been, imagine for a minute if communities around this country, as they addressed their issues, included in that what is best for us, those who broke into homes, those who were criminals for whatever reason, what if they were included in that what is best for us conversation? Let's come back full circle to Josiah Royce, the one who coined the term beloved community. Central to his understanding of beloved community was the importance of lost causes. Every community, of course, hopes for the accomplishment of its central cause, the fulfillment of that goal. But Royce placed particular emphasis on the phenomenon of loyalty to a lost cause. A lost cause doesn't mean a hopeless cause. Royce is talking about the cause that evokes our highest hopes and deepest moral convictions, and one that is open to critical feedback. But it is a cause that will not be fulfilled in our lifetime by a particular community. As James Baldwin said after Martin Luther King's "I Have a Dream" speech, that day, for a moment, it almost seemed that we stood on a height and could see our inheritance. Perhaps we could make the kingdom real. Perhaps the beloved community would not forever remain the dream that one dreamed in agony. When Martin Luther King spoke of the beloved community, Good evening. It's great to see you all this evening. A special welcome to those of you who are here for the first time worshiping with us at Unity. We're glad that you're here. We hope you find Unity Church to be a place which helps you to find and keep your balance, a place which nourishes you to lead a loving life of integrity, service, and joy. Following the service this afternoon, you're invited to join us for refreshments, coffee and tea in the parish hall. There you can meet old and new friends, visit our welcome table and the book stall. If you're interested in learning more about becoming a member of Unity Church, please visit the welcome table that's in the parish hall. Our children's and adult libraries are also open after every service and available to you. The libraries are on the second floor of the Elliott Wing. Join us this Wednesday for Wellspring Wednesdays. There's a dinner at 6 o'clock, a short worship service at 6:45, and then classes begin at 7:15. Our featured speaker this week is Kate Cabot, who is the author of The Voices of Rondo, which is a look at this community right here and just north of us. Should be a wonderful, wonderful lecture. Following this service in the Gannett Room, there will be an informational meeting about the upcoming trip to New Orleans in March. If you're interested in this trip, interested in going and rebuilding houses, cleaning houses, gutting these houses, please attend this session. Also, if some of you are interested and willing to give an occasional ride to a Unity member who is unable to come to church because of unreliable transportation or no transportation, there's a sign-up sheet on the welcome table in the parish hall. It could be a once a month or every 2 months commitment, but it would allow someone who's not a part of this worshiping community to be here with us and worship with us. So if you can give someone a ride, please sign up on that sheet. Next Sunday marks the official end of this year's pledge drive. As you know, it is your pledges that support Unity Church, the work and vision of this church. You should know that at this point we are about $60,000 short of our goal, about 94% of the way there. So if you haven't yet made your pledge, I invite you to consider what this church and its ministry means to you and the wider community, how its programs, classes, and various offerings have impacted your life as you seek to live a more full life of integrity, service, and joy. And if you've already pledged, and you feel like increasing your pledge, that's fine too. Next Sunday, Teresa Schwartz and Worship Associate Dick Bugs will lead the service entitled Deep Democracy. Services are at 9, 11, and 4:30. Finally, at the conclusion of the service, Teresa and I would love to meet you and greet you at the Portland Avenue doors. And once again, welcome to Unity Church.
Lead us from death to life, from falsehood to truth. Lead us from despair to hope, from fear to trust. Let peace fill our hearts, our world, our universe. let us dream together, pray together, work together to build one world of peace and justice for all. Come, let us worship together. Please join in our unison reading, number 580. The central task is to unveil the bonds that bind each to all. There is a connectedness, a relationship discovered amid the particulars of our own lives and the lives of others. Once felt, it inspires us to act for justice. It is the church that assures us that we are not struggling for justice on our own, but as members of a larger community. The religious community is essential, for where alone our vision is too narrow to see all that must be seen, and our strength too limited to do all that must be done. Together, our vision widens, and our strength is renewed.
Every Sunday when we gather, we set aside time to expand the caring ministry of this congregation. Together we recognize the cycle of life and death, the circle of love, compassion, and witness that permeates this sacred place. Our hearts are with all those who live with grief or chronic pain, for illnesses seen and unseen, those who live with addiction, those who care for family members in ill health, and those who knowingly face their final days with courage and dignity. This evening, our hearts are with Eleanor Felker, whose grandson died unexpectedly last week. We hold in our prayers Phil Dorn, who fell and cracked a rib last week. We hold in our hearts Katie Rivard, who is home from successful surgery and recovering. And our prayers are with Alex Chandler, who will be having surgery this Wednesday to remove a cancerous tumor. May we stand in compassionate solidarity with our neighbors all around the world who suffer in the midst of habitual violence. May they and we be instruments of a lasting peace. I now invite you to share the names of those people you would like to celebrate or memorialize or hold in the embrace this community. For the names which have been spoken and the names which remain in the silent sanctuary of our hearts, may we be forever grateful for the lives that have touched ours. And let us join together in prayer and silent meditation. Holy One, source of love and life, that goes by many names. We gather as one body this evening to celebrate all that we have and to rededicate ourselves to those things worthy of our deepest commitments. We give thanks for the fellowship and laughter in our lives, because it is fellowship and laughter that truly feed our spirit. We give thanks for the many hands and kind words that have supported us during moments of loss and grief, because it is love and kindness that heal our spirit. We give thanks for the opportunity to serve this world, to sing, to dance, to volunteer, to share our gifts with those around us, because it is in giving that we truly receive. We give thanks for life, for fellowship, for laughter, for family and friends, for the chance to do our part, to play our note in the music of life. Take time in our service this evening to recognize an important and vital ministry of this church, those who volunteer on Sunday mornings and Sunday afternoons to greet and welcome you to the church, to hand out orders of service, to be hospitable to you. I would like to invite Meg and Libby Arnasta to come up and speak to you a little bit about the Welcome Team ministry.
Every Sunday, for each service, a group of volunteers gathers to welcome members, friends, and visitors to Unity. They greet people at the door, set up coffee and tea service, hand out orders of worship, and take the offering.
Unity Church Unitarian has over 150 volunteers who staff the 12 welcome teams. Each volunteer serves at one service a month. Fifth Sundays are covered by special teams comprised of board members, coming-of-age participants, covenant groups, and other members willing to serve once a year.
To Today, we would like to recognize all the volunteers who have served on a welcome team in the past year. Your service is so important to the well-being of this church. Would all the welcome team members please stand so that the congregation can show its appreciation?
We thank you for your help and the warm hospitality you bring to each service.
If you're not a member of a welcome team, we invite you to join one. We would like everyone who attends Unity regularly to be on a team because many hands make light work. It's also a great experience for the team members, so come and join us.
Please fill out the form in your order of worship or contact Laura Park at the church. We also invite you to join us for the annual Welcome Team Potluck on Saturday, February 10th.
Since mid-October, every Sunday we collect and give away our offering to organizations and nonprofits in the community doing valuable, life-changing work in line with Unity's mission and values. This evening, our offering will go to the Open Cities Health Center, an organization that has existed for over 40 years, serving a wide population of people, many of whom do not have health insurance or insurance of any sort, and yet still receive medical care. It's a wonderful organization in our neighborhood, and our own Vivian Stone is a member of the board of this organization. I hope you'll give generously to this important cause. Will the ushers please come forward? May this offering be a blessing and a gift to those who receive it.
The Low Road by Marge Piercy. What can they do to you? Whatever they want. They can set you up, they can bust you, they can break your fingers, they can burn your brain with electricity, blur you with drugs till you can't walk, can't remember. They can take your child, wall up your lover.
They can do anything you can't blame them from doing. How can you stop them? Alone you can fight, you can refuse, but you can take revenge, but they can roll over you. But two people fighting back to back can cut through a mob. A snake dancing file can break a cordon. An army can meet an army. Two people can keep each other sane, can give support, conviction, love, massage, hope, sex. Three people are a delegation, a committee, a wedge. With four, you can play bridge and start an organization. With six, you can rent a whole house and eat pie for dinner with no seconds. And you can hold a fundraising party. A dozen make a demonstration. 100 fill a hall. 1,000 have solidarity in your own newsletter. 10,000 power in your own paper. 100,000 your own media. 10 million your own country. It goes on, one at a time. It starts when you care to act. It starts when you do it again after they said no. It starts when you say we, and you know who you mean, and each day you mean one more.
In 1966, Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. was the General Assembly's Ware Lecturer. There he talked about this term, creative maladjustment, and in his speech to several thousand Unitarian Universalists at General Assembly, he said, in part, "Yes, I must confess that I believe firmly that our world is in dire need of a new organization, the International Association for the Advancement of Creative Maladjustment. Men and women as maladjusted as the prophet Amos, who in the midst of the injustices of his day cried out the words that echo across the centuries, let justice roll down like waters and righteousness like a mighty stream. Yes, as maladjusted as Abraham Lincoln, who had the vision to see that this nation could not survive half slave and half free. As maladjusted as Thomas Jefferson, who in the midst of an age amazingly adjusted to slavery, cried in words lifted to cosmic proportions, we hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, that they are endowed by their creator with certain inalienable rights, that among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. As maladjusted as Jesus of Nazareth, who could say to the men and women of his day, he who lives by the sword shall perish by the sword. Through such maladjustment, we will be able to emerge from the bleak and desolate midnight of man's inhumanity to man into the bright and glittering daybreak of freedom and justice." In his book, I May Not Get There With You, The True Martin Luther King Jr., author Michael Eric Dyson recalls a sermon he hears at Riverside Church. It wasn't James Forbes who was preaching, however, it was Forbes's friend Charles Adams. Halfway through the sermon, Charles Adams turns his attention to the Martin Luther King holiday and the forces that seek to twist King's memory and thwart his progressive agenda. Charles Adams goes on in the sermon, "Perhaps the easiest way to get rid of Martin Luther King Jr. is to worship him, to honor him with a holiday that he never would have wanted, to celebrate his birth and his death without committing ourselves to his vision and his love. It is easier, said Adams, to praise a dead hero than to recognize and follow a living prophet." Dick Gilbert, a Unitarian Universalist minister and one of my teachers at Meadville Lombard, tells a story about a minister who preached at the church that Franklin Roosevelt attended when he was president. The minister receives a phone call one Saturday evening, and the caller asks, "Will the president be in church tomorrow?" And the preacher pauses just a moment and says, "Well, I'm not sure, but we do expect God to be there. And I think that's sufficient reason for good attendance." Dick Gilbert then follows this story with something from Soren Kierkegaard. "Too often in their churches, people adopt an attitude of the theater, imagining that the preacher is an actor and that they, the congregation, are his or her drama critics." And Kierkegaard offers this corrective. Actually, the people, the congregation, they are the actors on the stage of life, and the preacher is merely the prompter, reminding the people of their lost lines. And it is the holy that is the critical audience. At least that's the hope. That's the dream. It's certainly easier to hero worship or to be a drama critic, which is perhaps why generation after generation, prophets and sages and saints try to remind us of our lost lines. Their ongoing effort suggests that we do have the ability, that we know somewhere deep inside what those lines are, how we are to be in relationship with one another, with ourselves, with the world. But we are often forgetful, willful, resistant people. Today, let us listen to these living prophets, those whose vision and courage might lead us to a world of peace and justice, to the beloved community. It was Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. who popularized the term beloved community, but he was not the first to use this term. That distinction belongs to Josiah Royce, a late 19th century professor of philosophy. Royce imagined the beloved community as an ideal sort of community, a group of people who came together, who were committed to the cause of loyalty and truth and to ultimate reality, who came together with fierce loyalty and commitment to a particular . Yet long before Royce and King spoke of beloved community, it has had a deep yearning in the human heart. Perhaps an early version of the beloved community begins with Moses, the stuttering, reluctant leader of the Israelites, who leads them from slavery out of Egypt. As you remember, Moses has a mountaintop experience with God, where he receives the Ten Commandments, as well as this continued confirmation, this vision of the promised land, the place of milk and honey, of freedom for his people, of living in harmony. Perhaps Moses comes back down from the mountain and says to his people, as he notices they're worshiping a golden calf and questioning his leadership, maybe he says, "Well, guys, the good news is we've got them down to 10, these commandments. And this promised land sure does sound good. But you're dancing around a golden calf, and what are you doing? You've forgotten your lines, your promise, your covenant with one another. But Moses doesn't give up. He leads on to the promised land, traveling in the desert for 40 years. And as he nears the end of his days, Moses stands atop a mountain next to the promised land, a mountain right next to the promised land, and he looks over. He can see it. But he dies on that mountaintop, just short of the dream. Jesus, as a subversive wisdom teacher, speaks and acts out of a politics of compassion and rallies against the great evil as he saw it, the politics of purity. As author Marcus Borg says, the inclusive vision in Jesus' table fellowship is reflected in the shape of the Jesus movement itself. It was an inclusive movement, negating the boundaries of the purity system, those rules and regulations that denied a person's worth and dignity, and continually harmed women, the untouchables, the poor, the maimed, and the marginalized. In a society ordered by a strict purity system, separating the whole from the broken, the saved from the unsaved, the rich from the poor, Jesus' movement revealed a radically different social vision. And with this new vision, Jesus sought to usher in the kingdom of God, a new socio-political reality in which everyone, and then one more than you even imagined, would sit around the welcome table. Now, speaking of Moses and Jesus, and this may be a slight digression, have you heard the one about the burglar who breaks into a house and hears a soft voice saying, "Jesus is watching you"? He thinks he's imagining it, so he continues on through the house looking for things to steal, but again he hears this voice, "Jesus is watching you." So he turns around with his flashlight and he sees a parrot in a cage. He says, "Are you talking?" The parrot says, "Yeah." And he says, "What's your name?" "Moses," the parrot says. "What kind of crazy people name their parrot Moses?" says the burglar. "The same kind of crazy people that name their pit bull Jesus," says the parrot. Now, if you'll go with me on this, and this may be a stretch, but if you'll go with me on this, perhaps it's fair to say, and we'll come back to this joke later on, but it ties in. It's fair to say that Jesus was, in some metaphorical sense, a pit bull, fighting for peace and justice and the politics of compassion in his life. Certainly, his life and his ethics inspired Thomas Jefferson to create his own version of the Gospels. Jefferson, as you know, took a knife to the four Gospels and took out everything that was supernatural or the miracle stories, and what he was left with was the Jefferson Bible, as you probably know, and he considered that to be wisdom from the great common sense teacher. So obviously Jefferson was inspired by Jesus' ethics and teachings. And this showed up in the Declaration of Independence. When Jefferson wrote, "We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men, all people, are created equal, that they are endowed by their Creator with certain inalienable rights, that among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness." These self-evident truths point toward a beloved community waiting to happen. In the covenant of this country, the sacred promise of the Declaration of Independence was reaffirmed by Abraham Lincoln in his Gettysburg Address. He reminded the Union that it was dedicated to the proposition that all people are created equal, and that this nation under God shall have a new birth of freedom, and that the government of the people, by the people, and for the people shall not perish from the earth. Again, without saying it, Lincoln takes us right to the doorstep of the beloved community, lifting up those lost lines that we must remember if our grand experiment in democracy is to work at all. Granted, there is much missing in this loose exploration of beloved community, of its history and ideas. There's wisdom from Eastern philosophy and traditions. There's wisdom from native communities around the world. But one piece I don't want to skip is the way in which women have drawn out the deeply relational aspects of the beloved community. Author and lecturer Starhawk writes, "All is relationship. All is relationship. And we must make our relationships one of love, love of self and other, and raging love against all that would diminish the unspeakable beauty of the world." And Sharon Welch, a UU writer, says, "The beloved community names the matrix within life which is celebrated. Love is worshipped, and partial victories over injustice lay the groundwork for future acts of courage and defiance." This web or matrix of relationships is fundamental to any sort of beloved community. It is knowing and understanding the connectedness of things, knowing that the food grown here by certain people feeds people over here. It is knowing that a war fought over here pulls here and here and here on communities and countries. The web of relationships invites us to consider the we story. In their book, The Art of Possibility, Ben and Rosamund Zander explain the we story. The we story points to relationships rather than individuals. It is the story of the unseen threads that connect us all. It is the story of possibility. By telling the we story, an individual becomes a conduit for this new inclusive entity. An individual hears with bigger ears and eyes and feels with a bigger heart, inquiring and asking the question, what is best for us? If we describe revenge and greed and pride and fear and self-righteousness as the villain, and people as the hope, then the enemy to conquer is never a human being. And the question that is continually asked is, what is best for us? So if you thought that joke earlier was a little bit out of place, and it might have been, imagine for a minute if communities around this country, as they addressed their issues, included in that what is best for us, those who broke into homes, those who were criminals, what if they were included in that what is best for us conversation? Let's come back full circle to Josiah Royce, the one who coined the term beloved community. Central to his understanding of beloved community was the importance of lost causes. Every community, of course, hopes for the accomplishment of its central cause, the fulfillment of that goal. But Royce placed particular emphasis on the phenomenon of loyalty to a lost cause. A lost cause doesn't mean a hopeless cause. Royce is talking about the cause that evokes our highest hopes and deepest moral convictions, and one that is open to critical feedback. But it is a cause that will not be fulfilled in our lifetime by a particular community. As James Baldwin said after Martin Luther King's "I Have a Dream" speech, that day, for a moment, it almost seemed